You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Daniel Altman says his mission is to improve the quality of life for people around the world by helping them understand the global economy. He has served as an economics journalist on four different continents and currently teaches at New York University's Stern School of Business. His most recent book is Outrageous Fortunes, The 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy. It's published by Times Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Ever since the financial crisis, people have been wondering what the future will bring from the global economy, but you worry people aren't looking far enough into the future. Well, it's been my experience that predictions can be fun to make, but aren't they almost always wrong?
Well, predictions may be wrong a lot of the time. I mean, you just have to look at the weather forecast on television to see that. But it's usually better to have some idea of what might happen than to have no idea at all. You know, if you hear that there's going to be a 70% chance of rain, hey, it might rain, it might not, but you'll probably be glad that you brought an umbrella.
So who should be most concerned here? Individual investors or businesses and governments? We're talking about taking the long term into consideration, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And that's something that not everybody does that well. We have a society now which gets us to look at the short term most of the time. You know, if it's the quarterly earnings culture on Wall Street where everybody's looking to see that earnings number every 3 months, or it's our political system in Washington where we've got a 2-year electoral cycle. And so it's very hard to get politicians focused on the long term. But we have to if we're going to make the investments now in things like education and basic research, which are going to benefit us in the long term.
Are we talking about economists in academia as well?
Yeah, well, I think in academia, you're seeing different approaches to prediction. But what often happens, especially in the finance literature, is that people are looking at a long stream of numbers and they're just trying to predict the next number. What I think is much more important is to look at the underlying processes so you can understand the deep factors that create historical changes.
But didn't John Maynard Keynes say, in the long run, we're all dead?
I think that's definitely true. Our children are still alive, however. Sometimes we like to care about them.
You make predictions on a wide range of subjects: China, the EU, immigration, the American consumer culture. What about these predictions is surprising? Do your predictions differ from most economic forecasts?
Well, yes. I mean, if you take the first prediction in the book, it's about China, and it says that China, though it's going to get richer, it's going to become the biggest economy in the world probably within a couple decades.
Some people are saying right now, I just heard a report on Morning Edition, that if you use certain statistics as factors, you could say China right now has surpassed the United States.
Well, some of those statistics are more about adding up the total value of all the living standards of people in China. And that's relevant to people in China. But that doesn't tell you what their economic might is on the world stage, their ability to buy raw materials and to build aircraft carriers and to move markets.
So is you're saying China's economy will get bigger than the United States?
I think it will. I think in a couple decades, it will probably overtake the U.S. and become the biggest in the world. But I think eventually they're going to settle down into a long-term steady growth pattern, and their long-term rate of growth is going to be lower than that of the U.S., so we'll start catching up to them and eventually we'll pass them again.
You say there are growth limits?
Yeah, I think there are limits to growth. I think that the deep factors, as I said, of economies, which are like your market institutions, your protections for investors, your legal frameworks, your sort of entrepreneurial and innovative culture and atmosphere, those things are what set those long-term limits for growth. And I think they're a little bit more favorable in the United States than they are in China.
When you say that China's future depends on technology, are you talking about things other than computers and robotic manufacturing capabilities?
Yes, I am. I'm talking about a whole host of factors that are outside of the standard inputs that go into the productive process, things like your raw materials, capital, and labor. When you look at China's economy right now, yes, they're being pushed along by two big trends that we're pretty familiar with. One is the idea that people are migrating from farms into the cities to work in big factories and service operations. We saw that in the United States in the 20th century. We saw it in Japan. The other is that they're copying technologies and they're able to reproduce them and export them more cheaply. And we saw that in Japan too. But we also know that these trends eventually run out of steam. And when that happens, China's going to settle down and they're going to depend on what we can call technology, all the other factors that determine how they combine labor and capital in their economy to continue to grow.
And then you say the American economy will recover. Why isn't the United States close to reaching its economic limit?
Well, I think that we have matured in the sense that we're in that long-term steady growth pattern now, where we average economic growth of about 3% adjusted for prices. China, I think, will also settle down into a pattern like that. And like Japan, I think their pattern will have a lower average growth rate than what we have in the United States.
So was the United States like China at one point?
Absolutely. The United States went through this very same rural to urban migration trend in the 20th century, and it took several decades to max out. What we see with China is that it's moving through economic history much faster, and it's going to take a little less time.
So it's probably better right now to start a company in China than the United States.
I don't know if I would say that. If you look at a whole bunch of indices about the entrepreneurial climate and the ability to actually start a business, get the licenses you need, have your startup capital, hire and fire workers, do all those important things that entrepreneurs need to do, it's much easier still to do that in the United States.
But we are pretty much watching the manufacturing sector disappear. Yesterday, I talked to somebody who had written a book about Detroit and how they're dismantling factories and shipping them off to other parts of the world.
Well, we've seen about a third of the jobs in manufacturing disappear over the past few decades. But actually, our output in manufacturing has just grown and grown in value because we keep producing higher value products in a more efficient way. So it's not true that the manufacturing sector is disappearing, but the jobs in low-cost manufacturing are going elsewhere. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because if you were making cheap plastic toys in China and making a wage there that was just enough to live on, you'd never be able to live on that wage here in the United States.
My guest is Daniel Altman, who is the author of Connected 24 Hours and the Global Economy, Power in Numbers, which he wrote with Philippe Douste-Blazy, and Neoeconomy. His latest book is called Outrageous Fortunes, The 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy. It is published by Times Books. Aren't the theories of economics changing, behavioral economics replacing the neoclassical model?
Well, behavioral economics is becoming a very important adjunct to the neoclassical model. I think it enhances our understanding of how people make decisions. And in the book, I try to incorporate some of those tools. I'm trying in many cases, especially, for example, when I write about how countries change their trade barriers and open markets, to understand what the strategic interplay is between their goals. And actually, if you look at that, you find very interesting conclusions, such as the fact that negotiating outside of the World Trade Organization as regional blocks instead of a whole world trying to negotiate at once can actually open markets much more quickly.
So the global economy idea, the flat earth, isn't always the best way of looking at the world?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you flatten out the globe.
Have you told Tom Friedman?
Well, I'd like to tell Tom Friedman that if you flatten out the globe, some places are actually a lot further away from each other than they were on a sphere. Another thing I would point out that I think is probably an error in one of his theories is that as the global economy integrates, we're not actually going to eliminate all the middlemen. Actually, the middlemen are really important, as I write in the book. The middlemen are the people who allow you to expand across borders. If you're a company that wants to open a branch in a new place, you need lawyers, accountants, translators, all the people who are the gatekeepers to that economy. And there's going to be tremendous opportunities for those people in the future.
You question the idea that poor economies will catch up to wealthy ones over time. The convergence theory of people like Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia?
Well, I think that convergence is correct only when those countries share the same institutions. And that's what economists call conditional convergence. Conditional on having those same deep factors, those protections for investors, the ability to open a business, the innovative climate, all those things that I mentioned before separating the United States and China, those are what are going to separate countries into what we call convergence clubs, where they're going to be heading for that same limiting growth.
You also talk about politics as a factor in convergence. Well, China remains something of a totalitarian state. People have been predicting that in time it will become more democratic just because it will be required to by the nature of the global economy. Do you think that's true?
I don't, actually. I think that people are willing to sign a sort of social contract with their government in a lot of countries where they say, we can accept having fewer rights as long as our living standards continue to rise in a material fashion. And we've seen that go for a long time in countries such as Singapore, for example, which is one of the wealthiest in the world right now, and Taiwan also, where people gave up a certain number of rights in order to reap those economic benefits because they believed that they needed a slightly more authoritarian government to hold their countries together.
Well, there are other factors also. Access to the sea, for example, can hold back a country. The fact that it has to depend on one agricultural product. Right now, we've been talking a lot about Cote d'Ivoire and its problems, which is all based on the fact that it's the world's largest supplier of cocoa beans, but it doesn't have much else.
Yeah, I mean, countries that have diversified their economy away from one resource, like Indonesia, for example, which used to be very dependent on petroleum industry and some of the woods that they could harvest there, are going to do much better in the global economy because these markets are going to rise and fall. And if you're totally tied to one of them, then you're in trouble.
Isn't this similar in some ways to what Jared Diamond was arguing in Guns, Germs, and Steel?
Well, I have a slightly different point of view from his, I think, because I believe that a lot of these factors can change almost on a dime. I mean, take the example of Singapore again. Singapore is growing right now because it's a deep water port. There's a lot of petroleum trading that goes on there, and it's a great base for doing business both in India and in China. Those are all factors supporting its growth. But I think that those are going to change. You know, the deep water port won't be as important when we have the Northwest Passage. The petroleum trading is going online and virtual. And India and China are setting up their own financial hubs. They won't need to go through Singapore anymore.
So let's talk a bit about those convergence clubs that you mentioned. How do they work?
Well, typically what you see is the following. There is a group of countries that share similar institutions, and they can catch up to each other, meaning that the ones that have lower living standards can grow faster because they're able to copy technologies, as I said, with China, and they're able to learn from what other countries have done before, and they typically have lower wages as well, so they can produce at a cheaper rate and benefit from that. And that draws in capital when you're getting that high rate of return.
But that doesn't seem to be working in the case of China, which is close to South Korea and Japan, but they're not convergence clubs, are they?
Well, to be in a convergence club, you don't have to be neighbors. One thing that I saw when I was living in South America that was really interesting to me was an article in El Mercurio, which is a Chilean daily. And they were writing an article comparing themselves to a country that they essentially viewed was in the same convergence club as they were. It had the same sort of pro-market institutions in a democracy with pretty good legal protections for investors. And they sort of were trying to gauge how they were doing economically by comparing themselves to this country. This country was Estonia. A country with a much smaller population in a totally different part of the world, but they saw themselves as being in the same club, converging to the same potential limits for growth.
But can they work together, or this is just a matter of noticing similarities?
I think it's more noticing similarities, but they can definitely learn from each other because they're in the same position with the same institutions. If they want to improve, then they can imitate each other to try and get an even deeper limit for growth.
My guest is Daniel Altman. His latest book, Outrageous Fortunes, The 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy. It's published by Times Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Daniel Altman. His book, Outrageous Fortunes, The 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy. It's published by Times Books. What kinds of financial regulations do you need in a global economy?
Well, you need financial regulations that understand that financial markets truly are global. But what I see coming is a sort of disturbing trend where the enhanced regulation and monitoring that we're probably going to see in the traditional centers like New York and London and Hong Kong as a result of the crisis that we had a couple of years ago is probably
where there was a laxity of regulation.
That's right. Yes. So the enhanced regulation that will come as a result of that, some of the lessons learned from that, will probably force some investors and traders into offshore centers where they'll still be able to make all the exotic transactions that they want to make. And so it's probably going to lead to something like a financial black market.
Is there already a financial black market?
Well, I think it is already springing up. If you go to a betting website from an offshore center like the Bahamas or the Cayman Islands, you can often trade what are essentially derivatives on that website by betting on the value of the stock market or betting on the bankruptcies of major corporations.
What effect would a financial black market have on traditional markets?
It could have a really severe effect because you'll probably get pretty big investors going into these financial black markets to get different tax treatment, different kinds of transactions. But if there's a crisis in the black market, which is bound to happen because they're going to be doing these exotic transactions, it'll reverberate back in the traditional markets because it's affecting the very same investors.
But the only way to eliminate this sort of thing would be to get everyone on board. That seems to be unlikely.
I think it is unlikely because there's always an incentive for someone to defect from the coalition and say, no, I'm going to be the one that's going to host all these exotic transactions.
Well, we've seen how difficult it has been just to get Swiss banks to agree to live by the rules that everybody else wants to live by. And Switzerland is one of the most respected countries in the world.
That's true. But I think that exerting a little pressure can make a difference. A couple of years ago, when there was the first sort of major meeting of global economies after the worst moments of the crisis, Gordon Brown came out and said, he was the prime minister of the UK at the time, and said, we're actually going to put pressure on some of these countries that are acting as financial and tax paradises or havens, and we're going to get them to straighten up and fly right. And some of them actually did. Some of them that were on the watch list actually did come around and say, we're going to comply with regulations and disclosures.
On the other hand, we have been applying pressure on China for a long time to do all sorts of things. In fact, much of that was brought out with the recent visit of Hu to Washington. And China just resists, and it seems to be doing rather well, and I'm sure there's a message being sent to other countries.
Well, you know, China is a difficult country to govern in the best of times, and it's also a country, though, where the leaders can take a very long-term perspective because they're much more secure in their jobs than our leaders here. And doing that, they take a very steady approach to managing their economy, and they don't tend to accept a lot of outside counsel because they really think that they know what's best.
They have a strong sense of their own history, and China used to be a great world economic power, then went into decline for all sorts of reasons. But is the new upswing anything like the previous one? Is this China anything like the former great economic power?
Well, I think you have to look at this China and abstract away from some of the political constructs. China, as I said, it's a big country that was very difficult to unify centuries ago when it came together. Out of several disparate kingdoms. And I think Chinese are very conscious of that. And for that reason, they're probably more willing to accept a strong central government that's a little bit authoritarian than we would be perhaps in this country.
You say that China's economy will surpass the U.S. at least for a time, but not the European Union's? Isn't the European Union in serious trouble these days?
Well, I take the European Union almost as an implicit with that. The European Union, if you treat it together, is the biggest economy in the world right now, I believe. And yes, China will pass them as well. But I actually think that the European Union's future as an economic entity is very troubled.
Mm-hmm. And eventually it will fall apart. Is that because of the kinds of things we're seeing now with Greece and Spain and Ireland and Portugal and Italy?
I would say that's just the tip of the iceberg. If you look at the long-term risks and opportunities that are facing the countries in the European Union, as I have, you see that they're actually going on four separate tracks that are pretty distinct. And what's really startling about it is that these four groups of countries are actually geographically contiguous. So you could just draw two lines across Europe and basically split it into four segments that are ready to separate from each other.
But wasn't the European Union formed to create a strong to prevent war, not to create a strong economy? The economic cooperation just seemed to come along with everything else.
Well, the initial cooperation, which was to share and coordinate major industries in France and Germany, was to stop war after the Second World War. But it has become more an issue of economic integration with things like the euro, the common currency. But that's not really tenable if all your countries are going in different directions. You can't have a single monetary policy for four different economic cycles.
And now we have some of the countries talking about going back to their old their old currencies. Greece talking about the drachma, for example.
Yes, well, it's a very attractive proposition in some ways for a country like Greece. They are operating under the euro, which is a strong currency, but they'd like to be able to operate with a currency that's worth a lot less on international markets because it would allow them to sell their exports more cheaply, and then they could get a bit of a boost to their economy, which direly needs it.
Once a country reaches its economic limit, what can it do?
Well, it reaches that limit conditional, as I was saying before, on those institutions that it has. And you can improve those institutions. You know, after the fall of the Iron Curtain, all the Soviet satellite economies had a chance to wipe the slate clean and choose their institutions anew. And a country like Estonia chose, I would say, pretty well. They chose a pretty market-friendly climate, and they've received a lot of benefit in terms of foreign investment. Some other countries didn't probably choose as well, or they're choosing to depend more on their natural resources for wealth, and that's going to run out eventually.
You worry that a new wave of economic colonization might occur.
Yeah, I think it's already occurring, in fact. I think you're seeing China and Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and others who are buying up resources and land all around the world, but particularly in Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, to have the resources to feed their people and feed their economies in the future.
That's because they have a lot of money and nowhere to put it. Germany expanded territorially for similar reasons before World War II.
I think actually part of the reason is that they're worried about the future, that they're worried that they may not have enough resources to maintain stability and to keep their factories running. And they're trying to hedge that bet by buying these resources around the world. The problem is that they're offering billions of dollars to a lot of governments that aren't very good governments that might fritter away or waste the money in poor countries. And people are going to eventually rebel against what's going on.
Didn't we see something like that with the World Bank in Cambodia?
Well, the World Bank and Cambodia have had a very interesting and long relationship. I would actually give the World Bank compliments right now for one program they're doing in Cambodia, which is they're helping people to get title to their land in small farms all around the country. At one point, they were writing 10,000 titles a month. And this is the first step that can help people to move up the economic ladder. You know, it gives them the value of their land so they can sell it, they can start a business, they can move to a city, do something else other than subsistence farming.
Doesn't Jeffrey Sachs, I don't want to pick on him because I think he is a brilliant economist, doesn't he come up with some kind of justification for economic colonization?
Well, he thinks that it can be an arrangement that benefits both sides. But I think that he's missing sort of the political economy point, which is if China comes to a political leader in a poor country and says, here's $2 billion if you sell us your big copper mine, that leader's not going to say no. That leader would love to have all that money up front to achieve his or her political priorities. But that's not necessarily what's best for the country because a lot of these small poor countries, they can't absorb that kind of money so quickly. So it's going to be wasted. And then people are going to turn around and say, hey, why did we sell that resource? We need to use that resource for our own growth. They might try and reclaim it, and then you're going to have instability in that country. And back in China, where they tried to buy these resources to guarantee their economic future, they're going to be exposed to these risks all over again.
My guest is Daniel Altman. His latest book, Outrageous Fortunes, The 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy, is published by Times Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I know this isn't in the book, but you've also written about the global soccer market. And I wondered if the soccer market has reached its limit.
The soccer market, I think, still has a little ways to go. I think the choosing of Qatar and Russia for the World Cups in 2018-2022 is a signal that the leaders of the soccer federations believe that they still have room to grow, especially in developing countries and parts of the world that haven't historically been huge soccer areas.
And people were outraged when they were given the World Cup rather than the countries that we assumed would get them, including the United States.
Yeah, there was a lot of disappointment. I mean, there were 1.2 million, I think actually 1.5 million signatures collected in the U.S. to support the U.S. bid for the World Cup. And Qatar, which received it instead, only has 1.2 million people there. And it's really hot there in the summer.
So do you think it is a good idea? Their team seems to be doing very well.
I don't actually think it's a good idea. I think that it's a decision that was made for money reasons. I'm not suggesting that there was anything untoward in the process, but I think that it was believed that they would sell a lot more shirts in that part of the world, and that was good enough reason for them.
Do you think there'll be a battle of economic ideologies in the next century that similar to what we saw in the 20th century? Can we still define economies as simply socialist or capitalist?
Well, I think that is an ongoing battle, and I think the answer to the second question is no, that you always have a bit of a mix of both, that neither is sustainable in its pure form. But if you look at some of the countries where there's been a backlash against capitalism, like in Latin America and Eastern Europe, you see this swing to a left-wing populist government. which, you know, could go one way or another. It could be that the sort of quasi-socialist system will actually raise living standards. And I think if that happens, people will say, hey, you know, I've got a little money in my pocket now. I'd like to be entrepreneurial. Maybe a little dose of capitalism wouldn't be so bad. But if it doesn't work and it doesn't raise living standards, you can bet they're going to toss the bums out and probably bring in somebody from the other side of the pendulum, some right-wing government.
Which we've been seeing in Europe, haven't we? Even some of the Scandinavian countries have gotten rid of their socialist governments and brought in conservatives.
Yeah, but I think their pendulums are swinging with a much narrower period, actually. I think that it's more center-left versus center-right. Now, when that starts to happen in these economies like in Latin America, it can actually be really productive. You have maybe a center-right pro-business government come in, put in some sound economic policies, tight monetary, tight fiscal policy. But then you have a center-left government often succeeding them and legitimizing the policies by spreading around some of the gains that come from the resulting economic growth. And that is what has put Brazil on a path of steady growth in Chile, now Uruguay, and perhaps Peru.
Before Margaret Thatcher, one Brit joked that in Britain they had two parties just like the United States. They had the Labour Party, which we would call socialist, and they had the Conservative Party, which we would call socialist. That's no longer true there.
That's no longer true there.
But that was true for many countries in Europe.
Yes, but I mean, in France, you had a party called Socialist, and you had which was not really socialist as well. So I think, you know, European nations have settled down to a fairly kind of centrist system there, and they sway a little bit back and forth, but there's not a huge difference. What can happen that really can set the pendulum swinging again is when there's a surprise. I think, for example, people thought that George W. Bush was a lot more far to the right than they thought when they elected him, and perhaps Barack Obama's election would not have been possible without that. Perhaps Barack Obama was the pendulum swinging back to the left after that.
Although people on the left say that calling him a socialist is kind of a joke.
Well,
he's
yeah.
much further to the right than all of his critics on the right claim he is.
It doesn't take much to get called a socialist in this country. So I think calling just about anybody in Washington right now a socialist pretty much is a joke. You know, Bernie Sanders may have had a claim to that once upon a time, but not these days.
Peg, one of our listeners, asks, what about resources like fossil fuel, water, minerals, forests? How do they factor into the global financial analysis?
I think they really do. One thing that is a problem for us is that we're facing imminent shortages of a lot of really important metals for our economy, from basic metals like copper, which is almost unimprovable as far as a conductor that's cheap and easy to use, to rare metals like palladium and platinum that are used for chemical reactions and more complicated circuitry. That is going to cause us to have to find substitutes, and those substitutes will probably be more costly, at least in the short term.
But aren't we rich in rare metals? We just dropped out of the market because it wasn't making enough of a profit. We ceded it to the Chinese, and now that prices have gone up, I gather people in Minnesota and elsewhere are starting to go back into rare metals.
Well, it's just the same thing that you saw with fossil fuels when the oil price was nearing $150 a barrel. All of a sudden, oil deposits around the world that had gone untended for years become profitable. The Canadian oil sands, where you know you needed to have oil at least $40, some people would say $60 a barrel just to make it worth extracting the oil from those vast oil sands, all of a sudden were a booming operation, whereas when oil was $22 a barrel, it wasn't worth doing.
Amy in Manhattan asks, how does fair trade fit into this picture?
Well, fair trade is really a combination of the mission of opening markets and achieving some sort of social impact in improving living standards in developing countries especially. And I think that that's a values question. You know, it really depends on whether the world wants to get together and make this kind of social impact possible. Looking overall, I would say, you know, it's difficult to form coalitions for that kind of thing. You know, it's difficult to get people to coalesce around those kinds of norms. But I would say that at least now the consumer has the choice and the consumer can decide for him or herself.
What about agreements like NAFTA, which at the time promised all sorts of things? Now, whenever we talk about all of the drug trade and all the other problems in northern Mexico, NAFTA always seems to come up as part of the problem.
Well, I don't know if I could make a really strong link between NAFTA and the drug trade. You know, the drug trade was probably going to pass across borders, NAFTA or no NAFTA. You know, NAFTA might have been expected to do more in terms of creating employment in northern Mexico. There was this brief period where there were a lot of factories which would just assemble electronic components into consumer goods for the United States market. They don't do it anymore because it's cheaper to do it somewhere else now.
The British Empire went into decline, despite the fact that it relied very much on trade. Will we see the same thing happen in the United States in the long term?
Well, you know, my reason for thinking that the United States will come back and pass China again and regain the top spot as the biggest economy in the world is really based on the entrepreneurial and innovative climate that we have in this country. I believe that we have horizontal hierarchies in our business that make it easier for good ideas to percolate up from the bottom, for people with talent to have their ideas appreciated. Now, it's not a perfect meritocracy by any means. We can do a lot more to improve that.
Well, when President Obama suggested that we should think long term and build high-speed railway systems, many states balked, and now some of them have said we don't really want high-speed in our state. So are we just being short-sighted for political reasons? Or was that the wrong thing to be proposing?
Well, there is a whole series of investments that we could make that are going to increase the long-term potential of our economy to grow. As I said, education and basic research are a couple of these things. And these are difficult things to get politicians to commit to in the short term because the benefits often don't accrue until the very long term when they're not in office anymore. And I think investing in infrastructure is one of those things as well.
If China will reach a limit and the EU will disband in time, what kinds of countries do have rosy economic forecasts, in your opinion?
Well, I think that the countries which are starting to stabilize, as I said, like Brazil and Uruguay, Chile, are becoming very friendly environments for investors, and they can continue to improve their institutions, but that helps. I also think that—
But just let me interrupt about Brazil. Many people complain that the work ethic in Brazil has to change as well. It's just been too relaxed over the years. Part of what's made Brazil so charming has also meant that its economy has never really fulfilled its promise.
I think that that's changing little by little. I think that Brazil perhaps now is not the most attractive place in South America to invest. Corruption is definitely worse than in a lot of other countries that you could choose from. If you look at indices about how easy it is to do business and how much economic freedom there is, Chile and Peru typically come out on top. But Brazil is such a vast country. It clearly has a lot of potential. And I think that, you know, work ethic and the ability to get away with corruption and things like that are going to slightly diminish as it gets bigger and as its people demand more accountability from their government and higher standards of living.
We have very little time left, but your subtitle promises 12 surprising trends. We've been all over the place. Did we overlook any major trends?
I think one that is very pertinent for us right now is the idea of immigration policy changing in this country from something more politically motivated to something more economically motivated. Right now, our immigration policy is so political, but it really doesn't take account of the needs of our economy in the long term. It also doesn't help us to attract the most talented and brightest people from around the world. Meanwhile, other countries are laying out the welcome mat, and we're going to be giving up this source of growth that was so important to us, especially in the second half of the 20th century.
Daniel Altman is the author of a number of books. He's also the director of thought leadership at Dalberg Global Development Advisors, founder and president of North Yard Economics, a not-for-profit consulting firm that serves developing countries. He's written for The Economist, The International Herald Tribune, The New York Times, and currently teaches at New York University Stern School of Business. And his book is called Outrageous Fortunes, The 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy. It's published by Times Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate it.